This visit was destined to last several years. Since I had been there before, I had recovered my old calm and resoluteness. The former self-assurance had come back, and I had my eyes steadily fixed on the goal. I would be an architect. Obstacles are placed across our path in life, not to be boggled at, but to be surmounted. And I was fully determined to surmount these obstacles, having the picture of my father constantly before my mind, who had raised himself by his own efforts to the position of a civil servant, though he was the poor son of a village shoemaker. I had a better start, and the possibilities of struggling through were better. At that time, my lot in life seemed to me a harsh one, but today I see in it the wise workings of Providence. The goddess of fate clutched me in her hands, and often threatened to smash me, but the will grew stronger as the obstacles increased, and finally the will triumphed. I am thankful for that period of my life, because it hardened me and enabled me to be as tough as I now am. And I am even more thankful because I appreciate the fact that I was thus saved from the emptiness of a life of ease, and find that a mother's darling was taken from tender arms and handed over to adversity as to a new mother. Though I then rebelled against it as too hard a fate, I am grateful that I was thrown into a world of misery and poverty, and thus came to know the people for whom I was afterwards to fight. It was during this period that my eyes were opened to two perils, the names of which I scarcely knew hitherto, and had no notion whatsoever of their terrible significance for the existence of the German people. These two perils were Marxism and Judaism. For many people, the name of Vienna signifies innocent jollity, a festive place for happy mortals. For me, alas, it is a living memory of the saddest period of my life. Even today, the mention of that city arouses only gloomy thoughts in my mind. 5 years of poverty in that Frisian town. 5 years in which, first as a casual labourer, and then as a painter of little trifles, I had to earn my daily bread. And a meagre morsel indeed it was, not even sufficient to still the hunger which I constantly felt. That hunger was the faithful guardian which never left me, but took part in everything I did. Every book that I bought meant renewed hunger, and every visit I paid to the opera meant the intrusion of that inalienable companion during the following days. I was always struggling with my unsympathetic friend, and yet during that time I learned more than I had ever learned before. Outside my architectural studies and rare visits to the opera, for which I had to deny myself food, I had no other pleasure in life except my books. I read a great deal then, and I pondered deeply over what I read. All the free time after work was devoted exclusively to study. Thus, within a few years, I was able to acquire a stock of knowledge which I find useful even today. But more than that, during those years a view of life and a definite outlook on the world took shape in my mind. These became the granite basis of my conduct at that time. Since then, I have extended that foundation only very little, and I have changed nothing in it. On the contrary, I am firmly convinced today that, generally speaking, it is in youth that men lay the essential groundwork of their creative thought, wherever that creative thought exists. I make a distinction between the wisdom of age, which can only arise from the greater profundity and foresight that are based on the experiences of a long life, and the creative genius of youth, which blossoms out in thought and ideas with inexhaustible fertility, without being able to put these into practice immediately, because of their very superabundance. These furnish the building materials and plans for the future, and it is from them that age takes the stones and builds the edifice, unless the so-called wisdom of the years may have smothered the creative genius of youth. The life which I had hitherto led at home with my parents differed in little or nothing from that of all the others. I looked forward without apprehension to the morrow, and there was no such thing as a social problem to be faced. Those among whom I passed my young days belonged to the small bourgeois class. Therefore it was a world that had very little contact with the world of genuine manual labourers. For, though at first this may appear astonishing, the ditch which separates that class, which is by no means economically well off, from the manual labouring class, is often deeper than people think. The reason for this division, which we may almost call enmity, lies in the fear that dominates a social group which has only just risen above the level of the manual labourer, a fear lest it may fall back into its old condition, or at least be classed with the labourers. Moreover, there is something repulsive in remembering the cultural indigence of that lower class, and their rough manners with one another, so that people who are only on the first rung of the social ladder find it unbearable to be forced to have any contact with the cultural level and standard of living out of which they have passed. And so it happens that very often those who belong to what can really be called the upper classes find it much easier than do the upstarts to descend to and intermingle with their fellow beings on the lowest social level. For by the word upstart, I mean everyone who has raised himself through his own efforts to a social level higher than that to which he formerly belonged. In the case of such a person, the hard struggle through which he passes often destroys his normal human sympathy. His own fight for existence kills his sensibility for the misery of those who have been left behind. From this point of view, fate had been kind to me. Circumstances forced me to return to that world of poverty and economic insecurity above which my father had raised himself in his early days, and thus the blinkers of a narrow, petty bourgeois education were torn from my eyes. Now, for the first time, I learned to know men, and I learned to distinguish between empty appearances or brutal manners and the real inner nature of the people who outwardly appeared thus.
File 6.
At the beginning of the century, Vienna had already taken rank among those cities where social conditions are iniquitous. Dazzling riches and loathsome destitution were intermingled in violent contrast. In the centre, and in the inner city, one felt the pulse beat of an empire which had a population of 52 millions, with all the perilous charm of a state made up of multiple nationalities. The dazzling splendour of the court acted like a magnet on the wealth and intelligence of the whole empire, and this attraction was further strengthened by the dynastic policy of the Habsburg monarchy in centralising everything in itself and for itself. This centralising policy was necessary in order to hold together that hodgepodge of heterogeneous nationalities. But the result of it was an extraordinary concentration of higher officials in this city, which was at one and the same time the metropolis and imperial residence. But Vienna was not merely the political and intellectual centre of the Danubian monarchy. It was also the commercial centre. Besides the horde of military officers of high rank, state officials, artists and scientists, there was the still vaster horde of workers. Abject poverty confronted the wealth of the aristocracy and the merchant class face to face. Thousands of unemployed loitered in front of the palaces on the Ringstrasse, and below that Via Triumphalis of the old Austria, the homeless huddled together in the murk and filth of the canals. There was hardly any other German city in which the social problem could be studied better than in Vienna. But here I must utter a warning against the illusion that this problem can be studied from above downwards. The man who has never been in the clutches of that crushing viper can never know what its poison is. An attempt to study it in any other way will result only in superficial talk and sentimental delusions. Both are harmful. The first, because it can never go to the root of the question. The second, because it evades the question entirely. I do not know which is the more nefarious, to ignore social distress, as do the majority of those who have been favoured by fortune, and those who have risen in the social scale through their own routine labour, or the equally supercilious and often tactless, but always genteel condescension displayed by people who make a fad of being charitable, and who plume themselves on sympathising with the people. Of course, such persons sin more than they can imagine, from lack of instinctive understanding. And thus they are astonished to find that the social conscience, on which they pride themselves, never produces any results, but often causes their good intentions to be resented. And then they talk of the ingratitude of the people. Such persons are slow to learn that here there is no place for merely social activities, and that there can be no expectations of gratitude, for in this connection there is no question at all of distributing favours, but essentially a matter of retributive justice. I was protected against the temptation to study the social question in the way just mentioned, for the simple reason that I was forced to live in the midst of poverty-stricken people. Therefore, it was not a question of studying the problem objectively, but rather one of testing its effects on myself. Though the rabbit came through the ordeal of the experiment, this must not be taken as evidence of its harmlessness. When I try today to recall the succession of impressions received during that time, I find that I can do so only with approximate completeness. Here I shall describe only the more essential impressions, and those which personally affected me, and often staggered me. And I shall mention the few lessons I then learned from this experience. At that time, it was, for the most part, not very difficult to find work, because I had to seek work not as a skilled tradesman, but as a so-called extra hand, ready to take any job that turned up by chance, just for the sake of earning my daily bread. Thus I found myself in the same situation as all those emigrants who shake the dust of Europe from their feet, with the cast-iron determination to lay the foundations of a new existence in the new world, and acquire for themselves a new home. Liberated from all the paralyzing prejudices of class and calling, environment and tradition, they enter any service that opens its doors to them, accepting any work that comes their way, filled more and more with the idea that honest work never disgraced anybody, no matter what kind it may be. And so I was resolved to set both feet in what was, for me, a new world, and push forward on my own road. I soon found out that there was some kind of work always to be got, but I also learned that it could just as quickly and easily be lost. The uncertainty of being able to earn a regular daily livelihood soon appeared to me as the gloomiest feature in this new life that I had entered. Although the skilled worker was not so frequently thrown idle on the streets as the unskilled worker, yet the former was by no means protected against the same fate, because though he may not have to face hunger as a result of unemployment due to the lack of demand in the labour market, the lockout and the strike deprived the skilled worker of the chance to earn his bread. Here the element of uncertainty in steadily earning one's daily bread was the bitterest feature of the whole socio-economic system itself. The country lad who migrates to the big city feels attracted by what has been described as easy work, which it may be in reality, and few working hours. He is especially entranced by the magic glimmer spread over the big cities. Accustomed in the country to earn a steady wage, he has been taught not to quit his former post until a new one is at least in sight. As there is a great scarcity of agricultural labour, the probability of long unemployment in the country has been very small. It is a mistake to presume that the lad who leaves the countryside for the town is not made of such sound material as those who remain at home to work on the land. On the contrary, experience shows that it is the more healthy and more vigorous that emigrate, and not the reverse. Among these emigrants, I include not only those who emigrate to America, but also the servant boy in the country who decides to leave his native village and migrate to the big city where he will be a stranger. He's ready to take the risk of an uncertain fate. In most cases, he comes to town with a little money in his pocket, and for the first few days he's not discouraged if he should not have the good fortune to find work. But if he finds a job and then loses it in a little while, the case is much worse. To find work anew, especially in winter, is often difficult and indeed sometimes impossible. For the first few weeks, life is still bearable. He receives his out-of-work money from his trade union, and is thus enabled to carry on. But when the last of his own money is gone, and his trade union ceases to pay out because of the prolonged unemployment, then comes the real distress. He now loiters about and is hungry. Often he pawns or sells the last of his belongings. his clothes begin to get shabby, and with the increasing poverty of his outward appearance, he descends to a lower social level and mixes up with a class of human beings through whom his mind is now poisoned in addition to his physical misery. Then he has nowhere to sleep, and if that happens in winter, which is very often the case, he is in dire distress. Finally, he gets work. But the old story repeats itself. A second time the same thing happens, then a third time, and now it is probably much worse. Little by little, he becomes indifferent to the everlasting insecurity. Finally, he grows used to the repetition. Thus, even a man who is normally of industrious habits grows careless in his whole attitude towards life and gradually becomes an instrument in the hands of unscrupulous people who exploit him for the sake of their own ignoble aims. He has been so often thrown out of employment through no fault of his own that he now becomes more or less indifferent whether the strike in which he takes part be for the purpose of securing his economic rights, or be aimed at the destruction of the state, the whole social order, and even civilization itself. Though the idea of going on strike may not be to his natural liking, yet he joins it out of sheer indifference. I saw this process exemplified before my eyes in thousands of cases, and the longer I observed it, the greater became my dislike for that mammoth city which greedily attracts men to its bosom in order to break them mercilessly in the end. When they came, they still felt themselves in communion with their own people at home. If they remained, that tie was broken. I was thrown about so much in the life of the metropolis that I experienced the workings of this fate in my own person and felt the effects of it in my own soul. One thing stood out clearly before my eyes. It was the sudden changes from work to idleness and vice versa, so that the constant fluctuations thus caused by earnings and expenditure finally destroyed this sense of thrift for many people, and also the habit of regulating expenditure in an intelligent way. The body appeared to grow accustomed to the vicissitudes of food and hunger, eating heartily in good times and going hungry in bad. Indeed, hunger shatters all plans for rationing expenditure on a regular scale in better times, when employment is again found. The reason for this is that the deprivations which the unemployed worker has to endure must be compensated for psychologically by a persistent mental mirage in which he imagines himself eating heartily once again. And this dream develops into such a longing that it turns into a morbid impulse to cast off all self-restraint when work and wages turn up again. Therefore, the moment work is found anew, he forgets to regulate the expenditure of his earnings, but spends them to the full without thinking of tomorrow. This leads to confusion in the little weekly housekeeping budget, because the expenditure is not rationally planned. When the phenomenon which I have mentioned first happens, the earnings will last perhaps for 5 days instead of 7. On subsequent occasions they will last only for 3 days, as the habit recurs. The earnings will last scarcely for a day, and finally they will disappear in one night of feasting.
File 7.
Often there are wives and children at home, and in many cases it happens that these become infected by such a way of living, especially if the husband is good to them and wants to do the best he can for them and loves them in his own way, according to his own lights. Then the week's earnings are spent in common at home within 2 or 3 days. The family eat and drink together as long as the money lasts, and at the end of the week they hunger together. Then the wife wanders about furtively in the neighbourhood, borrows a little, and runs up small debts with the shopkeepers in an effort to pull through the lean days towards the end of the week. They sit down together in the midday meal, with only meagre fare on the table, and often even nothing to eat. They wait for the coming payday, talking of it and making plans, and while they are thus hungry, they dream of the plenty that is to come. And so the little children become acquainted with misery in their early years. But the evil culminates when the husband goes his own way from the beginning of the week, and the wife protests, simply out of love for the children. Then there are quarrels and bad feeling, and the husband takes to drink, according as he becomes estranged from his wife. He now becomes drunk every Saturday. Fighting for her own existence and that of the children, the wife has to hound him along the road from the factory to the tavern in order to get a few shillings from him on payday. Then, when he finally comes home, maybe on the Sunday or the Monday, having parted with his last shillings and pence, pitiable scenes follow, scenes that cry out for God's mercy. I have had actual experience of all this in hundreds of cases. At first I was disgusted and indignant, but later on I came to recognize the whole tragedy of their misfortune, and to understand the profound causes of it. They were the unhappy victims of evil circumstances. Housing and conditions were very bad at that time. The Vienna manual labourers lived in surroundings of appalling misery. I shudder even today when I think of the woeful dens in which people dwelt, the night shelters and the slums, and all the tenebrous spectacles of ordure, loathsome filth, and wickedness. What will happen one day when hordes of emancipated slaves come forth from these dens of misery to swoop down on their unsuspecting fellow men? For this other world does not think about such a possibility. They have allowed these things to go on without caring, and even without suspecting, in their total lack of instinctive understanding, that sooner or later destiny will take its vengeance, unless it will have been appeased in time. Today I fervidly thank Providence for having sent me to such a school. There I could not refuse to take an interest in matters that did not please me. This school soon taught me a profound lesson. In order not to despair completely of the people among whom I then lived, I had to set on one side the outward appearances of their lives, and on the other the reasons why they had developed in that way. Then I could hear everything without discouragement, for those who emerged from all the misfortune and misery, from this filth and outward degradation, were not human beings as such, but rather lamentable results of lamentable laws. In my own life, similar hardships prevented me from giving way to a pitying sentimentality at the sight of these degraded products, which had finally resulted from the pressure of circumstances. No, the sentimental attitude would be the wrong one to adopt. Even in those days, I already saw that there was a twofold method by which alone it would be possible to bring about an amelioration of these conditions. This method is first to create better fundamental conditions of social developments by establishing a profound feeling for social responsibilities among the public. Second, to combine this feeling for social responsibilities with a ruthless determination to prune away all excrescences which are incapable of being improved. Just as nature concentrates its greatest attention not to the maintenance of what already exists, but on the selective breeding of offspring in order to carry on the species, so in human life also, it is less a matter of artificially improving the existing generation, which, owing to human characteristics, is impossible in 99 cases out of 100, and more a matter of securing from the very start a better road for future development. During my struggle for existence in Vienna, I perceived very clearly that the aim of all social activity must never be merely charitable relief, which is ridiculous and useless, but it must rather be a means to find a way of eliminating the fundamental deficiencies in our economic and cultural life, deficiencies which necessarily bring about the degradation of the individual, or at least lead him towards such degradation. The difficulty of employing every means, even the most drastic, to eradicate the hostility prevailing among the working classes towards the state is largely due to an attitude of uncertainty in deciding upon the inner motives and causes of this contemporary phenomenon. The grounds of this uncertainty are to be found exclusively in the sense of guilt which each individual feels for having permitted this tragedy of degradation. For that feeling paralyzes every effort at making a serious and firm decision to act. And thus, because the people whom it concerns are vacillating, they are timid and half-hearted in putting into effect even the measures which are indispensable for self-preservation. When the individual is no longer burdened with his own consciousness of blame in this regard, then, and only then, will he have that inner tranquillity and outer force to cut off drastically and ruthlessly all the parasite growth and root out the weeds. But because the Austrian state had almost no sense of social rights or social legislation, its inability to abolish these evil excrescences was manifest. I do not know what it was that appalled me most at that time, the economic misery of those who were then my companions, their crude customs and morals, or the low level of their intellectual culture. How often our bourgeois rises up in moral indignation on hearing from the mouth of some pitiable tramp that it is all the same to him whether he be a German or not, and that he will find himself at home wherever he can get enough to keep body and soul together. They protest sternly against such a lack of national pride, and strongly express their horror at such sentiments. But how many people really ask themselves why it is that their own sentiments are better? How many of them understand that their natural pride in being members of so favoured a nation arises from the innumerable succession of instances they have encountered which remind them of the greatness of the fatherland and the nation in all spheres of artistic and cultural life? How many of them realize that pride in the fatherland is largely dependent on knowledge of its greatness in all those spheres? Do our bourgeois circles ever think what a ridiculously meagre share the people have in that knowledge, which is a necessary prerequisite for the feeling of pride in one's fatherland? It cannot be objected here that in other countries similar conditions exist, and that nevertheless the working classes in those countries have remained patriotic. Even if that were so, it would be no excuse for our negligent attitude. But it is not so. What we call chauvinistic education, in the case of the French people, for example, is only the excessive exaltation of the greatness of France in all spheres of culture, or, as the French say, civilization. The French boy is not educated on purely objective principles. Wherever the importance of the political and cultural greatness of his country is concerned, he is taught in the most subjective way that one can imagine. This education will always have to be confined to general ideas in a large perspective, and these ought to be deeply engraven, by constant repetition if necessary, on the memories and feelings of the people. In our case, however, we are not merely guilty of negative sins of omission, but also of positively perverting the little which some individuals had the luck to learn at school. The rats that poison our body politic gnaw from the hearts and memories of the broad masses even that little which distress and misery have left. Let the reader try to picture the following. There is a lodging in a cellar, and this lodging consists of two damp rooms. In these rooms a workman and his family live, 7 people in all. Let us assume that one of the children is a boy of 3 years. That is the age at which children first become conscious of the impressions which they receive. In the case of highly gifted people, traces of the impressions received in those early years last in the memory up to an advanced age. Now, the narrowness and congestion of those living quarters do not conduce to pleasant interrelations. Thus, quarrels and fits of mutual anger arise. These people can hardly be said to live with one another, but rather down on top of one another. The small misunderstandings which disappear of themselves in a home where there is enough space for people to go apart from one another for a while, here become the source of chronic disputes. As far as the children are concerned, the situation is tolerable from this point of view. In such conditions, they are constantly quarrelling with one another, but the quarrels are quickly and entirely forgotten. But when the parents fall out with one another, these daily bickerings often descend to rudeness, such as cannot be adequately imagined. The results of such experiences must become apparent later on in the children. One must have practical experience of such a milieu, so as to be able to picture the state of affairs that arises from these mutual recriminations, when the father physically assaults the mother and maltreats her in a fit of drunken rage. At the age of 6, The child can no longer ignore those sordid details which even an adult would find revolting. Infected with moral poison, bodily undernourished, and the poor little head filled with vermin, the young citizen goes to the primary school. With difficulty, he barely learns to read and write. There is no possibility of learning any lessons at home. Quite the contrary. The father and mother themselves talk before the children in the most disparaging way about the teacher and the school, and they are much more inclined to insult the teachers than to put their offspring across their knee and knock sound reason into him. What the little fellow hears at home does not tend to increase respect for his human surroundings. Here, nothing good is said of human nature as a whole, and every institution, from the school to the government, is reviled. Whether religion and morals are concerned, or the state and the social order, it is all the same. They are all scoffed at.
File 8.
When the young lad leaves school at the age of 14, it would be difficult to say what are the most striking features of his character. Incredible ignorance, insofar as real knowledge is concerned, or cynical impudence combined with an attitude towards morality, which is really startling at so young an age. What station in life can such a person fill, to whom nothing is sacred, who has never experienced anything noble, but on the contrary has been intimately acquainted with the lowest kind of human existence? This child of 3 has got into the habit of reviling all authority by the time he is 15. He has been acquainted only with moral filth and vileness, everything being excluded that might stimulate his thought towards higher things. And now this young specimen of humanity enters the school of life. He leads the same kind of life which was exemplified for him by his father during his childhood. He loiters about and comes home at all hours. He now even blackguards that broken-hearted being who gave him birth. He curses God and the world, and finally ends up in a house of correction for young people. There he gets the final polish. And his bourgeois contemporaries are astonished at the lack of patriotic enthusiasm which this young citizen manifests. Day after day the bourgeois world are witnesses to the phenomenon of spreading poison among the people through this instrumentality of the theatre and the cinema, gutter journalism and obscene books, and yet they're astonished at the deplorable moral standards and national indifference of the masses. As if the cinema bilge and the gutter press and such like could inculcate knowledge of the greatness of one's country, apart entirely from the earlier education of the individual. I then came to understand, quickly and thoroughly, what I had never been aware of before. It was the following. The question of nationalizing a people is first and foremost one of establishing healthy social conditions which will furnish the grounds that are necessary for the education of the individual. For only when family upbringing and school education have inculcated in the individual a knowledge of the cultural and economic and, above all, the political greatness of his own country, then, and then only, Will it be possible for him to feel proud of being a citizen of such a country? I can fight only for something that I love. I can love only what I respect. And in order to respect a thing, I must at least have some knowledge of it. As soon as my interest in social questions was once awakened, I began to study them in a fundamental way. A new and hitherto unknown world was thus revealed to me. In the years 1909 to 1910, I had so far improved my position that I no longer had to earn my daily bread as a manual labourer. I was now working independently as draughtsman and painter in watercolours. This métier was a poor one indeed as far as earnings were concerned, for these were only sufficient to meet the bare exigencies of life. Yet it had an interest for me in view of the profession to which I aspired. Moreover, when I came home in the evenings, I was now no longer dead tired, as formerly, when I used to be unable to look into a book without falling asleep almost immediately. My present occupation, therefore, was in line with the profession I aimed at for the future. Moreover, I was master of my own time, and could distribute my working hours now better than formerly. I painted in order to earn my bread, and I studied because I liked it. Thus I was able to acquire that theoretical knowledge of the social problem which was a necessary complement to what I was learning through actual experience. I studied all the books which I could find that dealt with this question, and I thought deeply on what I read. I think that the milieu in which I then lived considered me an eccentric person. Besides my interest in the social question, I naturally devoted myself with enthusiasm to the study of architecture. Side by side with music, I considered it queen of the arts. To study it was for me not work, but pleasure. I could read or draw until the small hours of the morning, without ever getting tired, and I became more and more confident that my dream of a brilliant future would become true, even though I should have to wait long years for its fulfilment. I was firmly convinced that one day I should make a name for myself as an architect. The fact that, side by side with my professional studies, I took the greatest interest in everything that had to do with politics, did not seem to me to signify of anything of great importance. On the contrary, I looked upon this practical interest in politics merely as part of an elementary obligation that devolves on every thinking man. Those who have no understanding of the political world around them have no right to criticize or complain. On political questions, therefore, I still continued to read and study a great deal. But reading had probably a different significance for me from that which it has for the average run of our so-called intellectuals. I know people who read interminably, book after book, from page to page, and yet I should not call them well-read people. Of course, they know an immense amount, but their brain seems incapable of assorting and classifying the material which they have gathered from books. They have not the faculty of distinguishing between what is useful and useless in a book, so that they may retain the former in their minds, and if possible skip over the latter while reading it. If that be not possible, then, when once read, throw it overboard as useless ballast. Reading is not an end in itself, but a means to an end. Its chief purpose is to help towards filling in the framework, which is made up of the talents and capabilities that each individual possesses. Thus, each one procures for himself the implements and materials necessary for the fulfilment of his calling in life, no matter whether this be the elementary task of earning one's daily bread, or calling that responds to higher human aspirations. Such is the first purpose of reading. And the second purpose is to give a general knowledge of the world in which we live. In both cases, however, the material which one has acquired through reading must not be stored up in the memory on a plan that corresponds to the successive chapters of the book, but each little piece of knowledge thus gained must be treated as if it were a little stone to be inserted into a mosaic, so that it finds its proper place among all the other pieces and particles that help to form a general world picture in the brain of the reader. Otherwise, only a confused jumble of chaotic notions will result from all this reading. That jumble is not merely useless, but it also tends to make the unfortunate possessor of it conceited, for he seriously considers himself a well-educated person, and thinks that he understands something of life. He believes that he has acquired knowledge, whereas the truth is that every increase in such knowledge draws him more and more away from real life, until he finally ends up in some sanatorium, or takes to politics and becomes a parliamentary deputy. Such a person never succeeds in turning his knowledge to practical account when the opportune moment arrives, for his mental equipment is not ordered with a view to meeting the demands of everyday life. His knowledge is stored in his brain as a literal transcript of the books he has read and the order of succession in which he has read them. And if fate should one day call upon him to use some of his book knowledge for certain practical ends in life, that very call will have to name the book and give the number of the page, for the poor noodle himself would never be able to find the spot where he gathered the information now called for. But if the page is not mentioned at the critical moment, the widely read intellectual will find himself in a state of hopeless embarrassment. In a high state of agitation, he searches for analogue cases, and it is almost a dead certainty that he will finally deliver the wrong prescription. If that is not a correct description, then how can we explain the political achievements of our parliamentary heroes, who hold the highest positions in the government of the country? Otherwise, we should have to attribute the doings of such political leaders not to pathological conditions, but simply to malice and chicanery. On the other hand, one who has cultivated the art of reading will instantly discern, in a book or journal or pamphlet, what ought to be remembered because it meets one's personal needs or is of value as general knowledge. What he thus learns is incorporated in his mental analogue of this or that problem or thing, further correcting the mental picture or enlarging it so that it becomes more exact and precise. Should some practical problem suddenly demand examination or solution, memory will immediately select the opportune information from the mass that has been acquired through years of reading, and will place this information at the service of one's powers of judgment, so as to get a new and clearer view of the problem in question, or produce a definitive solution. Only thus can reading have any meaning or be worthwhile. The speaker, for example, who has not the sources of information ready to hand, which are necessary to a proper treatment of his subject, is unable to defend his opinions against an opponent, even though those opinions be perfectly sound and true. In every discussion, his memory will leave him shamefully in the lurch. He cannot summon up arguments to support his statements, or to refute his opponent. So long as the speaker has only to defend himself on his own personal account, the situation is not serious. But the evil comes when chance places at the head of public affairs such a soi-disant know-it-all, who in reality knows nothing.
File 9.
From early youth, I endeavoured to read books in the right way, and I was fortunate in having a good memory and intelligence to assist me. From that point of view, my sojourn in Vienna was particularly useful and profitable. My experiences of everyday life there were a constant stimulus to study the most diverse problems from new angles. Inasmuch as I was in a position to put theory to the test of reality, and reality to the test of theory, I was safe from the danger of pedantic theorizing on the one hand, and on the other, from being too impressed by the superficial aspects of reality. The experience of everyday life at that time determined me to make a fundamental theoretical study of the two most important questions outside of the social question. It is impossible to say when I might have started to make a thorough study of the doctrine and characteristics of Marxism, were it not for the fact that I then literally ran head foremost into the problem. What I knew of social democracy in my youth was precious little, and that little was for the most part wrong. The fact that it led to the struggle for universal suffrage and the secret ballot gave me an inner satisfaction, for my reason then told me that this would weaken the Habsburg regime, which I so thoroughly detested. I was convinced that even if it should sacrifice the German element, the Danubian state could not continue to exist. Even at the price of a long and slow Slavization of the Austrian Germans, the state would secure no guarantee of a really durable empire, because it was very questionable if and how far the Slavs possessed the necessary capacity for constructive politics. Therefore, I welcomed every movement that might lead towards the final disruption of that impossible state, which had decreed that it would stamp out the German character in 10 millions of people. The more this babel of tongues wrought discord and disruption, even in the Parliament, the nearer the hour approached for the dissolution of this Babylonian empire. That would mean the liberation of my German-Austrian people, and only then would it become possible for them to be reunited in the motherland. Accordingly, I had no feelings of antipathy towards the actual policy of the Social Democrats. That its avowed purpose was to raise the level of the working classes, which, in my ignorance, I then foolishly believed, was a further reason why I should speak in favour of social democracy rather than against it. But the features that contributed most to estrange me from the social democratic movement was its hostile attitude towards the struggle for the conservation of Germanism in Austria, its lamentable cocotting with the Slav comrades, who received these approaches favourably, as long as any practical advantages were forthcoming, but otherwise maintained a haughty reserve, thus giving the importunate mendicant